couple of years.
And volunteer to pass these out. Not everybody's here yet, but most of them. In chapter 8, we hadn't quite finished it up, so if you'll turn to page 46 in your text, we want to look at these examples. We're dealing with sentence types that are what we call a predicate construction, and in Greek we don't need the verb form of the verb to be, but we will have two things in the nominative case in the sentence. And so the question, the ambiguity that arises, of course, is having two things in the nominative case. The question is, how do you decide which one of them is the subject, which one of them is the predicate nominative? And the criteria that was established, as we left off last time, was the fact that it has to do with the definiteness. Generally, what we're saying then is that the more definite of the two is the subject, and the least definite of the two is the predicate nominative. And that's, of course, on the assumption that when you're making an utterance like this, what you're trying to do is you have something specific in mind that you are relating to something a little bit more general. And you are assigning some attribute to it or associating with some other class of things, etc. So with that in mind, it seems a rather appropriate distinction. Now, in Greek then, there's five subcategories here that he lists as criteria to use to decide which one's the most definite. And the first one, and under part A of page 46, if one of the two nouns is a proper name, it is a subject. So being a proper name will make it the subject. And so he gives an example here in John 18:40, Ein ho Barabbas les deis. Barabbas was a robber. Now, ho Barabbas is the subject because it's a proper name. And that proper name, you're making something a statement about that one who's got a name, and you're associating with another class. Okay, so in other words, it'd be unlikely that you'd be saying a robber was Barabbas. You know, we could say that poetically, reverse the word order, but we're still getting the same meaning. In Greek, though, since word order isn't your critical thing, it's the idea of definiteness that's determining what is the subject and what is the predicate nominative. Okay, then B, if only one of the nouns has the article, it is a subject. So if one of the nouns has the article and the other one doesn't, that makes it fairly simple. The one with the article is a subject because the article gives a definiteness to something. So, os agapeiesten, esten, God is love. Because you've got theos for the article and love without the article, you know you're saying God is not is love, not love is God. You're talking about God specifically, and you're telling us an attribute of his nature, rather than talking about love and telling you an attribute of love's nature. Okay, so those are two pretty straightforward ones. If it's a definite, if it's a proper name, or if one of them has the definite article, the other one doesn't. Now the question is, if they both got the definite article, then you've got another situation.
Yeah, but also, like, would it make a difference, like, if neither one has a definite article?
If neither one had the definite article, in this case, you'd probably still opt for God being the predicate nominative, because it would still tend to be a little bit more definite than the idea of love.
Does it matter?
Well, the word order probably wouldn't make that much difference. Word order might put a little emphasis on something, but it's not going to really change the definiteness of it. If you put agape theos esten, I think you'd still opt for theos being the more definite of the two. You have to kind of look at definiteness rather than a word order or emphasis or anything in this particular situation. Some of those get a little gray line, you know. Some of the examples he's got, well, the next example here, I think, is even a debatable one in the way he set it up. So when you get things that both have the same external definiteness, you're having to decide definiteness on the basis of meaning or context or something like that, and that's where differences of opinion can come in, and things get a little bit more debatable. These first two instances where one of them's got the article, the other one doesn't, one of them's a proper name, the other one isn't, those are pretty straightforward. But look at C here. It says, if both nouns are equally definite or indefinite, the one which has the narrower reference is the subject. Okay, now that can get a little bit debatable, because one person may say this has got a narrower reference, and the other one may say the other word's got a narrower reference. Look at the example he's given. Hey hamartia esten, hey anomia. Sin is lawlessness, is the way he puts it. He puts sin as the narrower reference. Personally, I would reverse it. I would say lawlessness is sin. The reason I would say that is that the term sin, hamartia, means missing the mark, and there's lots of ways to miss the mark. And lawlessness is a specific example of how one can miss the mark. And if you do a Bible study on this, and examine all the different words for sin and do the associations, I think that's the conclusion I would come up with. But you can see here that there's a difference of opinion now. Getches has one opinion, I got a different opinion. But we're both using the same general criterion. We're trying to decide which is the more definite of the two, which has the narrower reference. I would say that anomia is a narrower reference than hamartia. He says it just the other way. So that shows you that we're dealing with something that's not quite as ironclad. And sometimes you may have to do some other external research in the scriptures to decide which is the more narrow reference. So he says there are other kinds of lawlessness besides sin. I don't know what that means, really. I would say just the opposite. There are other kinds of sin besides lawlessness. Okay, but in a certain sense, it's true that all sin is breaking a law. All hamartia breaks a law somehow. So if you're thinking of it in that vein, that's perhaps a possibility. But that's a real tough one. Now, another thing I should add here is that in cases like this where it's real debatable as to decide which one's the more definite, don't feel like you're compelled by some law of the universe to come down on hard on one side or the other and make an absolute decision. Because remember, we're dealing with a predicate construction in which things are being equated anyway. And if the things are being equated and it's real hard to tell which is the first member, which is the second member, it's not a big concern, because you're equating things anyway. And so I don't think you always have to feel like you've got to be able to decide which one absolutely and unambiguously is the subject and which one is the predicate nominative. I think if you're thinking in terms of the Greek picture anyway, you're just seeing two things in the nominative, they're being associated. And if you've got additional keys to show which one's more definite than the other, then you've got some sort of a directional arrow to the relationship. But if you don't have things that are all that definite, there may not be an arrow. It may be more like an equal sign. Don't worry about it. Okay? Now, D, if one of the two nouns has been referred to in the immediately preceding context, it is a subject. That's a fairly reliable guide. You see, if something's been referred to in the immediate context, then it has been the subject of concern, you see. It's been the thing that's been being focused on. Not one of them, and then the other one hasn't. So if you've been talking about one thing in the context already, and now you add some new information, and in this statement you repeat the mention of something you've already been talking about and then add some other characteristic to it, then the thing that's being repeated, in other words, the thing that's been mentioned in the context already, will be your subject, and the new information will be the predicate nominative. So, excuse me. Hey, Petra ein ho Christos. The rock was Christ. Well, in this case, in 1 Corinthians 10:4, he was already talking about the rock that followed them in the wilderness. And now he says the rock was Christ. Now, he's saying here that because in the context the rock was already being spoken of, both rock and Christ have the article, so you can't decide on the basis of that alone. Christos is a proper name, so that would seem to lend some support to Christ being the predicate, being the subject, and the other being the predicate nominative. But on the other hand, rock was being mentioned earlier, so in the development of the thought is, you've been talking about the rock, now you're identifying the rock. Now, he gives a note here, in this particular example, since Christ may be regarded as a proper name, the translation may be reversed, Christ was the rock. So he's saying you've got two opposing things here, and you could take it one way or the other. Again, you're facing the contextual situation. And here, I'm not so sure you need to have an arrow going one way or the other. It could be just an equal sign. It's just identifying with it. Because Christ is a proper name, but rock is something that's already been mentioned in the context. So I'm not sure this is the best example to pick. I think you could find other examples where something was being spoken of in the context, and it's real clear. Yes?
Really take Christ as a proper name.
Well, yes, anything that's, it's a title, of course, we recognize it's a title, but it's a title of an office, and so very often things like that are considered proper names as well, in terms of this distinction. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a name per se, it could be a title or office or something like this. That's often done, something like Savior or something like, what was that? Right, and we'll even capitalize those things because we're showing that there's a proper name association. This whole issue of what's a name, what's a title gets pretty technical when you get down to it. But okay, then the fifth point. If an equative verb joins a noun to a pronoun, the pronoun is a subject. Now, can you think of any rationale why that would be the case? If we've got a noun and a pronoun, why would the pronoun be the subject? Right. Whenever you use a pronoun, the reason that you can get by with using a pronoun is that you've already been talking about something in the context that enables you to substitute a pronoun for the thing that you're talking about because it's understood who you're referring to. In other words, if I just come out and say he went to the store without any previous context, you have no idea who the he is. And so my statement is somewhat unintelligible. I mean, you can understand the meaning of the words, but there's lots of question marks in your mind as to who I'm referring to and what's happening. But the reason is that I've used a pronoun without having an antecedent. So when you use pronouns in a text, there'll be an antecedent to the pronoun. There'll be something that the pronoun is referring back to. And that means then that something has been referred to in the previous context. And that would make the pronoun the more definite of the two, simply because you can use a pronoun only because you've got a very definite concept in mind. And that's what enables you to get away with using the pronoun. So the pronoun is going to be the subject when you see a pronoun linked with with another noun. So how tai asin duo diathekai. These women, the word women isn't actually there, but how tai is feminine form, so that's indicating that you're talking about women. Are two covenants, and he's talking this analogy with Hagar and Sarah. Okay, so these are the two covenants. These women are the two covenants. The feminine plural form of this pronoun is considered the subject here, and because this pronoun is a very definite concept. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Hey, when you were doing a word study or something, you're looking at the Greek, is there a proper way, the proper steps to go in determining the subject and the
In a construction like this, I would say that these five criteria are about the best way to do it. And just if you don't remember all five of them, they're not that hard to remember once you've been working with it. But if you don't remember all five of them, just be thinking which is the more definite of the two. Which is the more definite of the two? And there's several ways to get definite: proper name, article, just the meaning of the terms, which has a narrower reference, if it's a pronoun, so forth. Those are the things to keep in mind. Now, as I said, there will be some times where it'll be ambiguous and you won't be able to really nail it down absolutely from the statement alone. So that sometimes makes it necessary to look at a broader range of scriptures and so forth, or just to recognize that we needn't be too concerned about trying to establish which is the subject, which is the predicate nominative. We just are seeing two things being equated. And later in the second year, we'll get to doing some diagramming of Greek sentences, and it will be important when you're diagramming is to know which to put in the subject position, which to put in the predicate nominative position. Okay? But I would try to remember these five criteria. These are real good working rules to help you make a decision on this. And if none of these five rules gives you the answer, you're probably not going to find one. Okay? Now, section 59, one last note. It should be particularly noticed that when the predicate nominative precedes the verb in Greek, it generally does not have the article. Since this is true, it is frequently necessary to supply a definite article in English, even though there is none in Greek. So we mentioned that the use of the article isn't exactly one-to-one in English and Greek, and there are some, and this whole thing could be somewhat debatable too, but he's saying that when the predicate nominative precedes the verb, it generally does not have the article. And so you've got a certain definiteness that's coming, and in English we may want to translate it with the article. Now this is, I'm just going to give it to you as he gives it here, and there may be some debate about this issue. But notice the example, "Houtos o anthropos huios theou ein." This man was the Son of God. Now he's translated "the Son of God" because huios, the predicate nominative, is occurring before the verb, ein. The verb is in the last position here. And so he's saying that it could be translated "the Son of God" in English, even though the word "the" is not on the word huios. But he says, or "this man was a Son of God." So he says that it could go either way. Well, I'm not so sure how good a rule is that goes either way. So I think that we may just want to, you know, just note that what he said there, but take it with a grain of salt. As we get into this a little bit later on and start working in more detail with the article, I think that we'll have a little bit better basis for judgment on this. Okay, I'm not so sure that there's enough justifiable examples of this to really make it a rule. That's my opinion. Yes, Daniel?
And also, I thought John 1 where he says, "Theos ein holokos."
Mm-hmm.
These two translations, the second way he does in your eyes.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I think that there's always a reason in Greek why the article's there or not there. And so we have to be real careful here. So that's why I kind of put a question mark and a, you know, a big grain of salt there on this point 59. Because you're not going to find necessarily all Greek scholars agreeing, or you know, on this point anyway. Now, we will find some cases in which there are cases in which the Greek doesn't have the article, and in English idiom we would want to put the article. I'm not so sure that this is a case where that will occur all the time. Okay. go ahead then for tomorrow and do lesson 8 in your workbook. Let's see. A very long one, I don't think. Just pages W25 and W26. We've got the four sections, 8, A, B, C, and D. And we'll go through that class tomorrow. It's a relatively short exercise. And it's a little bit of review and a little bit of new stuff. There's really not a whole lot there. Okay, that's for tomorrow. And that brings us to chapter 9 on the adjectives. And this is a very important section. Adjectives are an important part of any language. And especially in Greek, because of the kinds of positions that adjectives occur in and the kinds of things that they do with adjectives. It's an important section. After we get through this chapter, we'll start giving some vocabulary lists and so forth, so we can start working on that part. But chapter 9, adjectives. Adjectives are important parts of speech in both English and Greek. A brief description of English adjectives is given first, so we may then proceed to compare and contrast their characteristics with those of Greek adjectives. So first, a little bit of review as far as English adjectives are concerned, and just what an adjective is. And again, he's starting out with the kinds of definitions that he's been using along the way here. He's going to be using a syntactic type definition here, and dealing with the positions that these words called adjectives can fit into in English sentence structures. English adjectives may be most satisfactory to define in terms of their syntactic characteristics as follows. An adjective is a word which may occur in positions similar to those occupied by hot and hostile in the examples below. Now, he does mention at the footnote here that there is a way to categorize these in a paradigmatic way, at least in English, big, bigger, biggest, that type of thing, because we do have comparative degrees and superlative degrees of adjectives. Greek will have that too, but we'll see that Greek has got some other inflections as well that English doesn't have. And so we're going to see that in Greek it's more appropriate to classify adjectives in both a paradigmatic type of way, with the kinds of inflections that they have, and the syntactic type of way. But in English, it's more appropriate for the syntactic. So here's how he's defining it. An adjective in English is a word which may occur in positions similar to those occupied by hot and hostile in the examples below. Number one is immediately preceding a noun. And then part A is without an article. So you can have hot water dissolve sugar quickly, hostile savages captured the missionaries. Or B, with an article, an or the. So either an indefinite or definite article in English. You can have A, hot cup of tea cheered him considerably. A, hostile environment warped his personality. The hot poker bent near the end. The hostile gestures caused him to withdraw. Okay, and then so the words hot and hostile are used in these positions. Then part two here, following an equative verb which has a noun as a subject. The weather is hot. His attitude was hostile. Okay, there you can have an adjective in a position following an equative verb, like the verb to be, and you're making a statement of a comparison or a statement of an attribute or something. So those are the basic positions that you're going to find adjectives in English. A number of English words occur in some but not all of the syntactic positions just described. These words may be classified in various ways. Some of the most important are mentioned here. Now, he gets into a lot of technical things here that we fortunately don't have to worry about since we're not studying English, we're studying Greek. But in English, you find that some words fit into some of those positions, but not all of those positions. And they would still be considered adjectives because they fit some of these criteria. So first of all, the articles, A and the, occur in position 1A, but not in 1B or 2. So in English, the articles, indefinite article and the definite article, are considered adjectives because they do fit into position 1A. In other words, you could say instead of, in 1A there, instead of hot water dissolves sugar quickly, you could say the water dissolves sugar quickly. Or instead of hostile savages, you could say the savages captured the missionaries. So those articles will fit into positions like that. But they won't fit into positions like 1B because 1B has the article before it. In other words, you don't say AA or A the cup of tea or something like that. In other words, the article isn't going to fit into that position. It's already part of that structure. And you won't see articles in the position 2 in a predicate construction. You won't say the weather is the or the weather is the, is a. The articles don't fit into those positions. And then his Roman numeral 2 here is the demonstrative. This, that, these, those do not occur in position 1B. So in 1B where you have an article, you don't have an article on a demonstrative. You don't say the this or a that or so forth. So they don't fit in that position, but they will fit in positions 1A, this water dissolves sugar quickly, you could say, or in position 2, I think this is, you have to strain it a little bit more, but you could use his attitude was this, or his attitude was that, and you could say that. You probably wouldn't say it very often, but it's possible. Okay, then Roman numeral 3, enough, the word enough occurs in 1A or in 2, but not in 1B. So you could say enough time has elapsed, 10 people are enough. You can have it opposite of an equative verb, or you can have it modifying a noun, but you're not going to say the enough or a enough. It's not going to fit that way. And then only occurs in 1A and 1B, but not in 2. Only lawyers can understand it. The only person there is my uncle, but you're not going to say he was only, or he was the weather is only, or something like that. It's just, it doesn't fit in that on the other side of the equated verb. And then 5, all occurs only in 1A, but may also precede the. So you can get all water dissolves sugar quickly, something like that. Then you can you can use the word all in a position something like 1B, but not actually in 1B. You don't say the all cup of tea, but you could say all the cups of tea or something like that. You could the word all is a little peculiar in that, and you could stick it out in front of the article in some positions. So those are just some of the features of English. You don't need to memorize or remember all those details as far as English is concerned. The Greek positions are bad enough as they are, but they're not that bad. Okay. Positions 1A and 1B are traditionally called attributive positions. And position 2 is traditionally called the predicate position. So attributive position means that the adjective is describing an attribute of the noun and is being used together with the noun as one basic unit, whereas the predicate position is a position in which a verb to be is either expressed or understood, it will be in the case of Greek, and there is an explicit statement of a comparison rather than a kind of an assumed comparison or attribute. It should be noticed, however, that English adjectives occasionally occur in other positions, although we do not use these other positions to define the adjective. So here's just another few features of English. Some adjectives may follow a noun. I never seemed to have money enough. He preached about life everlasting. The mailman collected 3 cents postage due. He is a devil incarnate. God Almighty will protect you. So in English, we can use an adjective following a noun instead of before the noun. And you might call that a different position if you wanted to. And fourthly, some adjectives may precede an equative verb of which the subject then follows. Blessed are the peacemakers, and so forth. Those are just features of English word order and English expression that are a little bit different than what we'll find in Greek. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. Just the basic distinction that we want to focus on, because it's one that the Greek will use, is this distinction between an attributive and a predicate position. And we'll try to make that more clear as we look at the Greek examples and focus in on that. Let's look at section 61 then. Whatever position an adjective has, it has the meaning of modifying, that is, qualifying, limiting, identifying, or describing the meaning of the noun with which it is connected. It should be clear, however, that this meaning cannot serve as a basis for defining adjectives, since many words may have this meaning in particular instances but do not qualify syntactically as adjectives. So he's shying away from using this as the definition for an adjective. It's the normal definition you get in English classes, as an adjective is a word that modifies a noun. But there are other words that modify nouns, too, that we wouldn't call adjectives. And he gives a couple of examples. The appointments committee met yesterday. You are the very man I'm looking for. Now, in both cases, the word appointments and the word very are functioning in these sentences as modifying a noun. In the first case, the word committee is being modified by appointments. It's telling you what kind of committee. And the word man is being modified by the word very in the second sentence. However, these two words, appointments and very, each has the meaning of modifying the following noun, and each has a syntactic position which is appropriate for adjectives. However, neither appointments nor very can have the second or predicate position with adjectival meaning. And they are on other grounds classified as noun and adverb, respectively. In such cases, it is convenient, as well as traditional, to say that appointments and very are used as adjectives or function adjectivally. So he's making a distinction here, and he's kind of leading into something that happens in Greek, too, that these words, appointments and very, are normally used in the normal syntax of English as being a noun or and an adverb. But in these particular sentences, they are being used adjectivally. And so the best way to describe this is to say here we have a noun being used like an adjective, and we have an adverb being used like an adjective. We'll find similar things happening in Greek. Yes?
We have the same problem that we have with garden. Talking about parts of speech. Garden, paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
A garden or the garden.
Right.
Gardens.
Sure.
Either a verb or a noun.
Right.
The same thing.
Yeah. Yes, it's kind of a matter of judgment, you know. You have to decide, well, which way is it used most frequently in the language? And that's usually what's determined. That's the only criterion he could say. You see, if you only had these examples, you might say that appointments and very were adjectives if you didn't see the words used any other way. But because most of the time the words are used a different way, then we say that, well, the word is probably this, but it's being used like this. It's just kind of a matter of how you split the hairs and how you decide things. And since appointments is a, now it's got the S ending, it's a morpheme, it indicates plural, this type of thing, they are generally associating that on the basis of paradigmatic distinctions and basic meaning and so forth, and syntactic positions as being a noun, and then saying it's being used adjectively. But you've got a point there. It's just a matter of, so if this particular word began to be used more frequently as in an adjectival sense than in a noun sense, then we might decide it's an adjective that's used sometimes like a noun. Because that'll have to, yeah, that's what's called a substantive. And I think that's going to come up in this chapter also.
Isn't that what we're redefining, the characteristics of words is not that, you know, in English we think a noun, this is a noun because it's a noun.
Yeah.
But he's saying if it fits the context of an adjective, therefore it is an adjective.
Mm-hmm.
So appointment isn't either a noun or an adjective. It's a word that fits the syntax.
Sure. Yeah, that's why he's... And finding out that English doesn't quite very well. You try to use examples in English to try to help the person get the idea that you're going to see in Greek, but it's not always perfect, and here's a good example of that. Okay, was there... Yes, Mike?
What he's doing here is he's focusing upon structure in
mm-hmm.
his definition.
Right.
Whereas we, dictionary orientation,
mm-hmm.
focus on words
mm-hmm.
definition.
Sure.
And so in this case... We got an overlap there, and there was a little bit of confusion.
Yeah, exactly. That's precisely what's happening. If you were consistently defining everything strictly in terms of structure, then you would call these words appointments and vary. You'd call them adjectives in this instance. You wouldn't really care whether they're used differently in other places. You'd call them something else if they're used in another structure. But because he's remembering that we are always associating these, generally associating these words in another category, he's kind of taken that category and then saying, well, here's an example where it's being used adjectively. But really, if you're looking only at structure, these are adjectives here because that's the way they're being used. Okay, and you will find places in which things that we normally call adjectives are used like nouns, and that'll be true in Greek also. Substantive is what the term is. The thing will be used very definitely as a noun. Article stuck on it and everything, and functioning independently, even having adjectives modifying it. Okay? That's coming up in this next section here. He mentions this. Conversely, section 62, and more important for us here, English adjectives, as defined in section 60, may be used as nouns, quote, or have substantive functions. That is, they may sometimes occur in syntactic positions which are generally appropriate to nouns. For example, we may say, he hath put down the mighty from their seat and hath exalted the humble and meek. Now, these words mighty, humble, and meek are all normally associated, very frequently associated, as adjectives because they describe nouns. But here we have no noun for them to describe, and they're actually functioning in a position as if they're nouns, the mighty or the humble and the meek. It is, of course, possible to say that nouns are understood here, though this would be difficult to give rules for deciding just on just the right noun to understand in many situations. But the fact remains that, as it stands, the sentence quoted is structurally parallel to, he hath put down the kings from their seat, which and hath exalted the beggars and slaves. And those are clearly nouns. So we can still tell that mighty, humble, and meek are not nouns because they do not have the plural morpheme s, which would be appropriate if they were. Okay, well, again, you can say that they're not nouns, or another person could come along and say that they're definitely nouns, and he doesn't care about the plural morpheme. Mm-hmm. And he's just going to define his noun purely on the basis of structure. So you can see he's having to compromise with the tradition and the new revelation, as it were, here. And I think for our purposes, it's just necessary to observe that we're dealing with functions, and that words, forms, and functions do not always... line up. Yes.
I think one of the key points is that language in any kind of language is much more fluid than we would like.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Familiarity is about the only thing that's really going to solve the problem.
Remember the original definition, he said, language is a very complex set of habits. And that's really what it is. If you're not convinced of that now, you will be by the time we're done with this book. Okay? So, and unfortunately, until you've got the habits, it's a little bit different. It's a little bit difficult to find out what they are and really, when you're approaching it like we are, already having spoken one language for most of our lives and now coming into introduction to a new language. A little Greek child doesn't worry about all of these things. He just speaks Greek. Okay? Now, section 63. Yeah. Section 63, we are now ready to turn to a discussion of Greek adjectives. Unlike English adjectives, all Greek adjectives have characteristic inflections, so that it is convenient to define them in terms of these and then go on to describe their syntactic behavior. So we've got a little bit more precision here as far as these paradigms in Greek. Greek adjectives are inflected for case and number, like nouns, and also for gender. So we've got three distinctions here. In the nouns, we saw that they were inflected for case and number. We had paradigms for the case and number. Singulars and plurals, and then the nominatives and accusatives we've had so far. But the adjective is going to also be inflected for gender. Because remember that a nouns occur in three genders, masculine, feminine, and neuter. But a noun, being the kind of word it is not going to change its gender. It's only got one gender all the time. But when you're going to use an adjective to modify a noun, adjectives that you are going to use, sometimes you may be sticking them on a masculine noun, sometimes on a feminine noun, sometimes on a neuter noun. And so the adjective is going to be attached to various kinds of nouns. And therefore, for rules of concord, the adjective is going to adjust its endings to in agreement with the kind of gender of noun that it's stuck onto. And so this makes the adjective paradigm a little bit more complicated in that you've got the various genders to deal with. Now remember, we've really already had one of these. We've already dealt with an adjective, the name of the article, that did just this. And this is nothing new than what the article does, basically. If you remember what the paradigm of the article did, that's basically what's happening here. Okay? So we have the adjectives inflected for gender as well, so that they're going to agree with their noun in case, number, and gender. So if the noun's a masculine noun, the adjective form is going to have masculine endings. If the noun's a feminine noun, that same adjective may have a feminine, first declension feminine type ending to agree with that feminine noun, and so forth. Same with neuters. Okay, so section 64, the Greek adjectives we shall take up in this lesson are said to be of the first and second declensions. Now that is a statement that leaves you with the sick feeling that maybe there's some more kinds of adjectives, and there are. There are third declension type adjectives. We'll be examining those quite a bit later on. But we're only going to worry about adjectives that are in first and second declensions. In other words, a given adjective is both in the first and second declensions. It's second declension in the masculine and neuter forms, and it's first declension in the feminine form, just like the article was. The article is basically second declension in the masculine and neuter forms, and first declension in the feminine forms. So they're called first and second declension adjectives. They have feminine forms like those of feminine nouns of the first declension. Now remember, not all feminine nouns are in the first declension, but the majority of them are. And so the adjective, when it is attached to a feminine noun, regardless of the declension of the feminine noun, it's going to have endings like the first declension feminine nouns do. And they have masculine and neuter forms like the forms of the masculine and neuter nouns of the second declension. The illustrative paradigm should be compared with the noun paradigms in Lesson 6. So let's look at an example. Most adjectives are declined like kalos, meaning good. So this is the majority of your adjectives in Greek. Now there are some third declension adjectives that we'll be dealing with later on. But this is the most common pattern for adjectives. And so now notice that you've got them inflected for singular and plural, for nominative and accusative, and we'll also have genitive and dative to add to this later. But then also for masculine, feminine, and neuter. And you've got one common element in all of these, the call part, and then you've got an ending. And that ending is going to be different depending upon whether it's masculine, feminine, neuter, whether it's singular or plural, and whether it's nominative or accusative. So the paradigm then for the masculine forms is kalos for the nominative singular, kalon for the accusative singular, kaloi for the plural nominative, and kalus for the accusative plural. And that's just exactly like Theos was, remember. That's just exactly the same ending system that Theos had. Second declension, masculine nouns, those are the types of endings that the masculine form of the adjective takes. Now, the feminine form, we've got kale, kalein, kalai, kalas. That's exactly like feminine first declension nouns that we've seen before. So they're going to, you don't really have anything new to memorize here. You just have to apply the rules that you've seen before to the situation. Then the neuter, kalon, kalon, kala, kala, exactly what we've seen before. The omicron nu ending, and remember in the neuter, there's no difference between nominative and accusative. So you've got kalon, kalon, kala, kala. Yes?
Just to make sure I understand this, then. The adjective matches the article and not the ending on the noun itself.
Right. The adjective is going to, at least for those that are short second declension adjectives, once we get third declension adjectives, they won't even necessarily rhyme with the article. But so far, they're going to be like the article, not necessarily like the noun. For example, you could have, let's say you have a noun that is a... Yes, okay. Let's say we've got homotetes, okay? Well, homotetes is a first declension masculine noun. So if I wanted to say the good disciple, how would I say that?
Basis of it.
Yes, ho kalos mathetes. So the rhyming, you see, is not coming through here. You've got kalos mathetes, but it's kalos because mathetes is a masculine noun. Being masculine, that's going to determine second declension endings for the adjective. But the noun, being a first declension masculine, is going to have first declension endings. So just like with the article, with the adjective now, the endings will not always rhyme. More often than not, they will, because the majority of your second declension nouns are masculine, the majority of your first declension nouns are feminine, but it's not going to be always. And the same with hodos, for example. Remember, hey hodos, how would I say the good way? On the basis of that. Remember, hey kale hodos. That's right, hey kale hodos. Those are the areas you have to watch so you don't get tripped up, because the tendency is to want to make the adjective ending rhyme with the noun ending. But it won't always do that. Most of the time it will, but not always. Okay? Yes?
I don't really want to get into it too much. On the third declension adjective, it's not so much the adjective. Here we're giving particular adjectives, particular words, and they are called first and second declension adjectives because if you stick them with a noun, they have a certain kind of ending. But then there are adjectives that even though you stick them with, say, a second declension masculine, they'll have a different ending.
Yes. They'll have third declension type endings even when they're stuck on a second declension masculine noun. But we'll worry about that in due time. It's, fortunately, there's not as many third declension adjectives as there are third declension nouns. So, but we will have to be familiar with them and learn them when we get there. Okay? But this is your most common pattern. This is by the vast majority of your adjectives follow this pattern. And the same thing's going to happen, too, when we get to third declension nouns. And we have an adjective like this stuck onto a third declension noun, then your endings aren't going to rhyme there either. Okay? But we want to try to break you in slowly and easily, you know, and take a little bit of time. Once you get familiar with this, then it won't be nearly as hard to handle something new. Yes?
Is the article always the way we've learned it, even though it's stacked on a third declension?
Yes, right. The article is the same as we've always learned it, no matter what kind of nouns you're going to deal with in the future. That's one thing that you can count on. So the article paradigm is not going to change. So for the word for faith, hey pistis, you've got the iota sigma ending, but the article's still hey. Okay? Okay. So basically now, all you need to do is apply your knowledge of second and first declension endings and recognize that with the adjective, the masculine forms of the adjectives will always be second declension masculine endings. The feminine forms of the adjective will always be first declension feminine type endings. And the neuter forms of the adjective will always be neuter second declension endings. Always, you know, of this type of adjective, in other words. It'll always be that way. Regardless of the declension of the noun that they're attached to. Okay? And this is why I said that sometimes if the noun does not have the article, and you haven't seen the noun before, but it does have an adjective on it. From that adjective, you can often tell what the gender of the noun is. You know, normally you can tell with the article, but if it's anarthrous, but it happens to have an adjective on it, you can tell from the adjective ending what the gender is, because the adjective inflects for gender. So it is giving you gender information. The noun is not necessarily giving you any gender information. It's only if you happen to memorize the dictionary form and know the article that goes with it. But the adjective will give you that information. So that's handy in that respect. Okay, section 65, the dictionary form of an adjective is its nominative singular masculine. You see, the dictionary form of a noun was just the nominative singular form. But for an adjective, you have to add another piece of information to designate a particular form. You've got to have gender information. So by convention, they've chosen the masculine to be the form to use for the dictionary form. So the dictionary form of an adjective is its nominative singular masculine. So in most cases, that's going to mean that the dictionary form of an adjective, of these types anyway, is going to end in omicron sigma. And I think this is one area where a person who doesn't really understand the rules involved can get confused sometimes when he's looking in the dictionary, because there are many second declension nouns that end in omicron sigma also. And so to look at a word that ends in omicron sigma, you can't really tell whether it's a noun or an adjective. And there's other information you've got to look at to be able to decide that. So that's, again, I think a lot of people have had confusion because they look up a word and they're not really sure of all these grammatical rules. They see some similar endings and make some assumptions that may not be right. Okay, so for the word kalos, for example, you would look up in the dictionary, you'd look it up under kalos, the nominative singular masculine form. And then adjectives are frequently cited with endings of the other genders indicated. This is going to depend somewhat on the editors of the text or the book that you're looking at, but the majority of them will give this information simply so that you can tell whether this happens to be a third declension adjective or not. It gives you the other ending. So look at the way you find it normally. Kalos, comma, a, comma, on. Now, what that is telling you is that, and this is not to be confused with an article following it. Remember the nouns, you had the dictionary form of the noun, then you had the genitive singular form, and then the article. So you had three pieces of information there, but they were different pieces of information. For the adjectives, you have the nominative singular masculine form, then in comma, then you have the feminine form, or the feminine ending, which will be eta in this case, and then you'll have the neuter ending, omicron nu. So that just tells you what the whole paradigm is. It tells you that you're using first declension, second declension endings for the masculine forms, first declension eta type endings for the second for the feminine forms, and second declension neuter forms for the neuter forms. Now you might say, well, if all adjectives do the same thing, why give this information? In other words, the fact that they're giving this information is a hint that sometimes adjectives may not always act the same way. And you have one area, first of all, and that's the thing that's mentioned next. This feminine endings in eta will not always be the case. There will be sometimes where there'll be alpha. Just like with the nouns, remember, when the stem ended in a roll or a vowel, then you had alpha-type endings rather than eta-type endings. And the same thing's going to happen exactly with adjectives. And so, section 66 says, adjectives which have roll or a vowel, most frequently iota, immediately preceding the ending, omicron sigma, of the dictionary form, have alpha in the feminine singular, all cases, instead of eta. So, here's an example, mikros, meaning small, we get micro from that. We've got mikros, mikron, mikroi, mikrus for the masculine. In the feminine, because the stem ends in a roll, instead of having mikre, you have mikra. Mikra, mikron, mikrai, mikras. So, in the dictionary form then, well, I guess that'll be given in a moment here, the neuter forms, there's no problem there. So, it's only in this first declension feminine type endings that you're going to get alphas instead of etas when the stem ends in a roll or a vowel. So a full dictionary citation for this adjective would be mikros, comma, alpha, comma, omicron nu. So in the dictionary form, if you have any doubt about what it's going to do, it'll tell you there. If you see an alpha there instead of an eta, you know that it's going to form its endings in the singular forms of the feminine forms are going to be with alphas instead of etas. Okay. Then he gives a list of the most frequently encountered adjectives of this type. And this type meaning that they've got a stem that ends either in a vowel or in a roll. And most often it's a vowel iota. You have a whole class of them that have the iota stem. So hagios, meaning holy. If it were in the feminine, if you're applying it to feminine singular noun, it'd be hagia. See, not hagie, but hagia. Idios, one's own, dikaios, dexios, makarios, necros, there's one of the stamens in a row, necros, heteros, poneros, presbyteros, necros. So these are some of the most common adjectives that have this feature. They'll have alpha-type endings instead of eta-type endings. Still first declension, and we've already seen the same thing with nouns, so it shouldn't be a surprise that it happens with the adjectives too. And just something to pay attention to. Stem ends in a row or a vowel. You want to make this change. Any questions on that? Okay, and that will be reflected in the dictionary form. That's why some of them you'll see with alpha instead of eta there in that second position. And then there's one other feature that we need to point out, and that is that some adjectives have no separate form for the feminine gender. There aren't a whole lot of these. Ionios is the one that's most common. I think it's the only one that's used more than 50 times in the New Testament. So Ionios is one you want to take special note of. This word means eternal or everlasting, so forth. Now, Ionios, instead of having a separate form for the feminine, instead of having Ionia, for example, for the feminine form, there are no feminine forms. So they'll use Ionios, the second declension type forms, for both masculine and feminine nouns. So the paradigm for that is masculine or feminine. Ionios, Ionion, Ionioi, Ionius. It's the same second declension endings, but it's used for either masculine or feminine nouns. So there aren't many nouns like this. So I would just record Ionios in your mind as one that's unusual in this respect. If you can remember Ionios, you probably won't get stumped on this. I don't think we're going to run into very many adjectives like this, at least not for quite a while. So a full dictionary citation for this adjective is Ionios, comma, on. So you only have one additional ending there for the neuters. There's no separate ending for the feminine. And that's the way these types of adjectives will be recorded. Just no separate endings for the feminine, indicating that it's got the same endings for masculine and feminine. So the fact that the adjective has no separate feminine form is indicated only by the fact that no separate feminine ending is indicated. Adjectives of this type are not very common in the Testament. Ionios, comma, on, eternal, is the only one which occurs more than 50 times. Okay, any questions on that? So I would just make a note in your mind that Ionios is unusual. So whatever you're using Ionios, see, the thing that's going to trip you up is, suppose you've got a noun that's feminine, and for example, Chera or something like that. If you wanted to say eternal widow, I don't know if you'd ever want to say that, but if you wanted to say that, it would not be Hey Ionia Chera, it would be Hey Ionios Chera. And so that's going to be a little tricky. It looks like somebody's made a mistake there. You've got Ionios Chera, but that's the way it is. That particular adjective has no separate feminine form. Don't know the reason for that. That's just the way it is. Okay? Yes?
Zoe, Ionios.
Yes, right. That's one that's more common. It's good. Zoe is word for life, and you'll see this phrase quite often in the New Testament dealing with eternal life. And it'll be Ionios Zoe, or Zoe Ionios, not Ionia, as you might have expected. Okay, good. All right. Then now we get into the syntax. So that's the forms. You've pretty much got that down. If you know the article, you haven't got too much more new information to learn. But now we have the grammatical distinctions and how the position of the adjective affects meaning, the structural meaning of these adjectives in Greek. And this is, I suppose, a little bit more difficult than English. It's not terribly difficult. It's just that in Greek we do have both a predicate and an attributive position, and those positions are especially carefully defined with reference to the article. So we'll have to take this piece by piece and begin to see how these are used. And this is a thing, a pattern, that's going to become important in later discussions of things like the demonstrative adjectives and other things. We're going to be using these predicate and attributive position type terminology later on in other things too, so it's something we really need to know. All right, the most important details are given below concerning the syntax. Number one, concord or agreement. An adjective agrees with the noun it modifies in case, number, and gender. That is, the form of the adjective is determined by the case, number, and gender of the noun it modifies. So, the adjective is going to agree. The adjective is kind of a slave to the noun. It's going to agree with the noun in case, number, and gender. And whatever the case of the noun is, the adjective will follow suit, and number and gender likewise. So, a few examples. Pistos diakonos, a faithful servant. Kaine entole, a new commandment. Agathon ergon, a good work. So there's a masculine, a feminine, and a neuter form. They're all nominative here. Notice that the ending of the adjective is not necessarily the same as that of the noun that it modifies. And again, the reason that the ending is not necessarily the same is because of the fact that the gender and declension distinctions don't line up. In other words, the adjective is following a pretty rigid set of rules as far as what forms it has per given gender, whereas the noun may be feminine first declension or masculine first declension. It may be feminine second declension or masculine second declension. So because of that, you're not going to get a rhyming of the endings very, at least not always. So hilaros dotes is an example. The dotes is a first declension masculine noun, but hilaros is following second declension endings because the masculine forms of the adjectives always follow second declension endings. And mikra phone is not rhyming in this case because they're both first declension endings, and they're both feminine form. Well, the adjective's got to be feminine if the noun is, but the adjective mikra, the stem ends in a row, whereas the noun phoné, the stem ends in a nu. And so you can use the eta endings for the noun here, but you have to use the alpha endings for the adjective. Zoe, ionios, we just talked about. Ionios is the peculiar form of adjective that doesn't have separate feminine forms. And he kale hodos. There's another example where you have a second declension feminine noun, and so because it's feminine, you're going to have kale rather than kalos there. Okay, that's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow we'll go through the exercises of Lesson 8, and then we'll pick up on these adjectives and finish out Lesson 9. If you came in late, didn't get your test paper, have it here. Chris Matthews, Dan Carr, Randy Thrasher, Tony Masati, Eileen Sepka, you're here. Come on up and claim it.